Good afternoon. May it please this honorable court. Jess Marchese appearing on behalf of Mr. Deonte Reed. This is an appeal from the trial. It's basically the exact same facts and circumstances of the last case. Mr. Jackson is actually Mr. Reed's half-brother on his maternal side. We raised three issues in our brief, Your Honors. The first went to the issues of those multiple specific instances of contacts with the criminal justice system which Mr. Reed had had in this case. And our argument is that this evidence came in incorrectly as predisposition evidence. Now, the timeline on this case is...
Well, why isn't that a good argument? I mean, it's if you want to prove you raise entrapment, they want to prove predisposition, why can't you introduce prior bad acts?
Our argument is that many of these acts were not prior bad acts. They actually happened after the...
I take your point on that. But, I mean, do you concede that some of the acts should have been admitted?
Yes, under other theories of law. There was one instance which my client took a Taurus pistol from a residence. And I believe that that could come in under the preparation theory under character evidence.
That was the home invasion that was conducted within a month of this incident.
Yes, it was about a month before. It was a gentleman that was serving in the Air Force.
The claim was that he felt he needed an additional pistol to pull this job off, and that's why he had the home invasion.
You are correct in that. Yes, Your Honor.
Are there any other pre-crime incidents that you contest?
Yes. Some of these other pre-incidences which came up, it was a robbery in which my client pled guilty to a gross misdemeanor conspiracy charge in which he had the allegation was that he conspired to rob someone, and that came in at the trial. That occurred in February, I believe, of 2008. And that was one of the issues. And then there was also the other instances, which kind of goes into my second argument. There were 16 felonies that my client pled guilty to in state court, which came in as well, which I believe that the government used as predisposition evidence and against us for our entrapment argument. Now, like I said, it goes into our second argument that this is, I believe, is an area of unsettled law within this circuit. I was unable to find a case right on point. The government pointed to a case where the court allowed a guilty verdict to be used against a defendant at trial. However, the area of a guilty plea to be used as impeachment at trial is an area that is unsettled. Now, the issue that's before the court now is whether or not that was proper to allow that in for impeachment purposes. Because it's unsettled, it leaves me a little bit of latitude to argue in front of Your Honors. And one of the arguments that I would make is the difference between an actual guilty verdict and a guilty plea, as we have in this situation. And what I would submit to the court is this was 16 felonies. Basically, my client, I did not handle the case, but my client pled guilty in state court to the entire sheet. There was no offer. The entire information is what he pled guilty to. I personally told him that he should probably try to go ahead and withdraw that guilty plea. Now, he never did. There was no motion that he filed. However, he never went ahead and did that. But at the same time, he still had the ability at the time that he was in trial in the federal district court to petition the state district court to go ahead and do that. So that's where I think that the difference between the actual guilty verdict and the guilty plea come into play.
I could ask you a question, please.
Sure.
On that difference, why wouldn't that just go to weight? In other words, why couldn't the government introduce evidence of a plea, but the defendant, if he wanted to contradict it, say, don't give it much weight because it's not a conviction, then we have a right to seek to have it withdrawn or whatever?
So the question is that when it's brought up in trial, the defendant can then argue that we still have that remedy to go ahead and withdraw the guilty plea?
Yeah, why shouldn't it be admissible to show disposition subject to whatever arguments are presented on the other side, that it shouldn't be given so much weight?
Well, I believe that that's twofold, Your Honor. First, my argument is that many of it wasn't predisposition because it was these incidents happened after the contact with the informant of the government in April of 2008. That's number one. And then secondly, I still believe that it's overly prejudicial to hear that, because if he still does have that remedy, it's the old cliche in saying in courts that you can't unring the bell, that he pled guilty to 16 separate felonies. That's a huge criminal liability in which the jury would hear, and then, you know, they're hearing that, and whether there's a limiting instruction or whatever is argued, it's still very prejudicial to him.
Well, leaving aside his potential ability to withdraw the plea, why do you think a plea is any different from a verdict conceptually? I mean, it's, in some ways, you may say it's stronger evidence.
Well, I'm not in the business of speaking poorly about other attorneys. However, my advice to Mr. Reed was just trial, because if you're given an offer of just plead directly to 16 felonies, it's my experience that with the state's overworked caseload and whatnot, he's at least going to get some not guilties on some of them.
Yeah. So basically, well, but that's the toothpaste is out of the tube on that one, I guess.
Yeah.
You'd say. So, but, conceptually, I mean, just because we're dealing with this area, and you say there's a distinction between a plea and a verdict, why do you think that makes any difference in terms of admissibility to show predisposition?
Well, one of the arguments that I used was to the impeachment issue. But as to predisposition, I'll just go back to my original point in that. My issue is that once it happens after the initial contact with the government agent, then it shouldn't be used as predisposition. Maybe as other theories under the law, but predisposition, no.
You've got about 2.5 minutes left. Any questions before we hear from the government?
The only question I had was,
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Reed also appeal the sentence or just the conviction?
No, I raised the sentencing entrapment issue to Judge Dawson, but in front of Your Honors here today, that was not within the briefs.
Thank you.
Very good.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth Olson for the United States. The defendant raises several interrelated claims, but they all sort of at bottom come down to the district court's decision to admit evidence of various criminal acts that Mr. Reed had engaged in. And as Mr. Marchese pointed out, one of those things is sort of not like the other. The May 5th, 2008 burglary in which Mr. Reed stole the pistol that he brought to the stash house robbery meeting place. Mr. Reed actually testified at trial that he committed that burglary because he knew he needed a bigger gun for the stash house robbery. So that, I think, is clearly admissible under 404B to show preparation, and I believe Mr. Marchese has conceded that. With respect to the other three, the other criminal acts all involve, there was a residential burglary on December 4th of 2007, a residential burglary on December 5th, 2007, and a attempted armed robbery in February of 2008. All of those evidence about each one of those crimes was admissible to show the defendant's character, the character, his character having been placed directly at issue when he made the decision to raise an affirmative offense, defense of entrapment. Now, the district court didn't specifically discuss 405B, rule of evidence 405B, and didn't cite it, and I don't think any of the parties cited 405B either. But the district court did correctly instruct the jury that evidence of these crimes could be considered for whatever, however they might bear on the defendant's predisposition. And that is, you know, that is what 405B says. When character is an element of a defense, specific instances can be used to show the defendant's character. With respect to the timing of predisposition, and this is actually a really interesting question, and I think that because if you look at this Court's cases, not only this Court's cases, but the Supreme Court's cases, Pullman and Jacobson and even Curtin and even Williams, which ends up going in our favor on that one, but the language that those decisions use is exactly precise as it needs to be for the case, given the facts of the case at issue. So, for example, Pullman says that the relevant time frame for assessing a defendant's predisposition comes before he has any contact with a government agent. Okay, well, in the case of Pullman, the first contact he had with the government agent was the instigation of the sting. Right? I mean, it began, the sting began with that first contact. Whereas in Williams, where it was a case like this one, a fictional stash house, where the defendant had initially met with a paid government informant and then was ultimately brought to the undercover agent who proposed the robbery. In Williams, this Court says the question of predisposition is to be determined prior to the time the government agent suggested the criminal activity. Okay. And in fact, that's not exactly, respectfully, that's not exactly right, because in Pullman, the, you know, there was this, the sting started, and the woman, the person pretending to be this woman who wanted to have a man have sex with her young children, started this months of conversation, kind of almost grooming, talking him into convincing before she finally made the offer. And once she made the offer, the defendant was at a place where he said yes. But this Court said you can't just look at just when the offer was made. You have to look at what led up to that. Okay. So I think the key for me is that the language in Pullman, which says that the time frame for assessing predisposition before, comes before the defendant has had any contact with a government agent. Okay. We know that cannot be read literally. Because literally, you know, this defendant got a speeding ticket in 1994, and he had contact with a government agent, right? So it can't be literally. So the question is, what is the constraining principle or the limiting principle? And it seems to me that if you read all of these cases, regardless of the language that they use kind of for that point, what they're talking about is when the defendant first had contact with a government agent in the context of this sting operation, right? Mm-hmm. And so the fact that this defendant met the tattoo artist, who was a confidential informant for the for these ATF guys, he met this tattoo artist in October of 2007 and sold this confidential informant a gun. And so the confidential informant said to the agents, hey, there's this guy I just got a gun from. And then they start investigating him, and they find out that he's a suspect for these burglaries, and that he's, and then he gets arrested for this attempted armed robbery. And then, as they get more information that leads them to believe that this is a dangerous criminal who needs to be taken off the street, then they decide to propose this undercover, to do this reverse sting, to propose this stash house robbery to him. Now, to say that the fact that he happened to have met this confidential informant several months earlier means that all of the information on which the agent based the decision to target this individual, to propose this sting, that none of that can be used because of the fortuity that he happened to meet this tattoo artist in October of 2007. I mean, that's really as absurd as saying, well, you know, I got a speeding ticket in 1994, and so I had government contact, and anything after that can't be used. All of these, with the exception of that May 5th, which was the burglary that was specifically committed in preparation for the stash house, these other events, the home invasion burglaries in December of 2007 and the attempted robbery of a drug dealer in February 2008 were completely independent of this sting operation and in fact, were completely independent of the confidential informant, so which is why this is even stronger than the case in Williams, because in Williams, the paid government informant was actually engaged in criminal activity with the defendant. And even then, this court said that you could look at that criminal activity that he conducted with the confidential informant or with the paid informant as evidence of predisposition because it all happened before the instigation of the sting. I think that needs to be the now because of that and because it's all admissible under 405B, you don't really have to address the question if you don't want to about 609 and whether a guilty plea constitutes a felony conviction that is admissible under 609. But that's also an interesting question, and if the court wants to reach it, I think that I think it might have been Judge Gould who said, Judge Thomas, what's the difference between a guilty verdict and a guilty plea? And I guess the government's argument is that there shouldn't be one in this context, that that it is in the court's interest and it's in the judicial system's interest to ensure that when a defendant stands up in court, raises his hand, swears to tell the truth, and admits that he committed these crimes, the question of whether he committed those crimes is now off the table. I mean, that's been decided. That's been admitted. And, of course, yes, there are situations in which a defendant can be permitted to withdraw his plea the same way, you know, a guilty verdict can be overturned on appeal. And Rule 609 specifically says that just because a case is on appeal and could possibly be reversed, that guilty verdict is still admissible under 609. So I would say that for the same reason, because the colloquy that goes into a Rule 11, I mean, the Rule 11 colloquy before someone is permitted to plead guilty emphasizes that this is a solemn, real situation that has absolute consequences from the moment you plead guilty.
Well, in federal court.
In federal court. Well, although I think...
I mean, there are some states where the colloquy is pretty...
Yeah.
Cursory.
Yeah. And the district court did. I mean, obviously, this particular issue didn't come up, or I'm not sure that this was to what extent this was discussed. I know that the colloquy of the guilty plea in the state court to these 16 felonies, and all these 16 felonies all involved those three crimes: the robbery on December 4th, December 5th, and May 8th. There were several statutes violated with respect to each one of those acts, but they were just those three incidences. And the district court did have that. Probably shouldn't say that. I'm pretty sure the district court had the guilty plea colloquy before it. I know I've read it. So, unless the court has other questions.
Any questions?
No questions.
All right. Thank you.
Just briefly, and this might have been my error in when I did the briefing, as to the predisposition, I agree that part of my argument is that I take a more literal reading of Pullman and its litany. However, I would agree with the government in that if my client had a speeding ticket in 1994 and it was a completely separate government agent than the ones that he was dealing with in here, if it was relevant in some way, shape, or form, then yes, that's going to come in for predisposition. However, my argument here is I'm not talking about predisposition. When I'm talking about the predisposition should begin, it began when he had contact with this individual named Fat Cat, the individual that was the government agent in our argument because he was working for the government. And he also was the one that introduced my client to Agent McCarthy, one of the ATF agents that was a part of this investigation, and sold a gun to him. So it wasn't just that he met Fat Cat and then all of a sudden he met these agents who went ahead and proposed this stash house robbery. There was a little bit more communication with the parties.
Okay. Interesting case, both of them. Thank you both for your arguments. Again, the court thanks you for your patience this morning and the long calendar, and we'll be in recess.
Thank you.